If you fear a specific object or situation, you may be able to recall an experience in which your amygdala learned that fear. Alternatively, it may be difficult to uncover how an amygdala-based fear developed, since your cortex isn't able to retrieve a memory related to that situation, even though the amygdala clearly does. The fact that the cortex can be left out of the loop is why people are often confused by their emotional responses. Here's an example to illustrate what this confusion is like. Lily recognized that she had social phobia when she learned about the symptoms of social phobia on an anxiety website. She knew that she felt uncomfortable in groups of people and that it was difficult for her to attend family gatherings like Thanksgiving dinner or a sister-in-law's baby shower. When her therapist told her that this anxiety was probably due to her amygdala, she had no idea why her amygdala had developed this emotional response. But after her therapist asked her to identify the specific characteristics of the gatherings that provoked anxiety, Lily said that being in a circle of people, even cheerful family members, was very distressing. She recognized that a circle of people was terrifying to her, especially when they all could look at her at once. When the therapist asked Lily if she could think of an experience that could have taught her amygdala that a circle of people was dangerous, Lily recalled an event in second grade when she was in a circle of children reading aloud from their books. When it was her turn to read, she had difficulty, and the teacher treated her in a way that made her feel humiliated. The cortex-based memory of this experience finally came back to Lily, and she understood why her amygdala had created an emotional memory to try to protect her. Because of that memory, her amygdala responded to a circle of people as though they posed a danger. Realizing that your amygdala stores emotional memories that your cortex has no knowledge of can help you better understand some of your emotional reactions. Sometimes the cortex has a complete lack of understanding of the origins or purposes of the emotional reactions created by the amygdala. But you can learn more about these processes, so in the next chapter, we'll help you and your cortex become more knowledgeable about the workings of the amygdala. Summary. Two pathways can create anxiety. One pathway travels the detail-focused circuitry of the cortex and eventually sends information to the amygdala, which produces an anxiety response. The other pathway runs directly from the thalamus to the amygdala. Each pathway can cause the amygdala to create anxiety, but each is also constructed of circuitry, and certain aspects of that circuitry can be modified. If you understand how the circuitry works, you can rewire your anxious brain so that you experience less anxiety. Chapter 2. The Root of Anxiety: Understanding the Amygdala. Don't be fooled by the small size of your amygdala. Even though the largest and most developed portion of the human brain, the cortex, contributes to anxiety in many ways, the amygdala plays the most influential role because, as you learned in Chapter 1, it's involved in both the cortex pathway and the amygdala pathway to anxiety. Like the conductor of an orchestra, the amygdala controls many different reactions in both your brain and your body. In addition to relying on pre-programmed responses, it's also exquisitely sensitive to what happens to you and responds to your specific experiences. In this chapter, you'll learn about the amygdala's special language and its impact on your life. In evolutionary terms, the amygdala is an extremely ancient structure, and the human amygdala is quite similar to the amygdalas found in all other animals. Because the human amygdala is so similar to that in rats, dogs, and even fish, researchers have been able to study its functioning in depth and have learned a great deal about how it creates fear and anxiety. When you're born, your amygdala has pre-programmed responses that are ready to be put into action. But this ancient structure isn't fixed. The amygdala is constantly learning and changing based on your day-to-day experiences. In fact, once you understand what we call the language of the amygdala, you'll have more control over your anxiety responses because you'll know how to influence the part of the brain that's at the very root of fear. The amygdala as protector. To understand amygdala-based anxiety, it's useful to think of the amygdala as your protector. Natural selection has given humans a fear-producing amygdala that has protection as a central goal. As you go about your day, the amygdala is vigilant for anything that might indicate potential harm. While the goal of protection is good, the amygdala can overreact, creating a fear response in situations that aren't really dangerous. Consider Fran, who's about to give a speech. Her heart begins to pound, and she starts to hyperventilate as soon as she stands in front of the group with everyone staring at her. What is her amygdala trying to protect her from? It seems as if it sees the situation of standing in front of an audience as dangerous. Fran is not alone in experiencing this type of response. Studies have shown that fear of public speaking is the most commonly reported fear, surpassing fear of flying, fear of spiders, fear of heights, and fear of tightly enclosed spaces. What could account for this common response? Because the amygdala tries to prevent us from being prey to a predator, evolutionary scientists have suggested that we may be prone to interpreting eyes watching us as a potentially dangerous situation. Others have suggested that the risk of rejection by a group of observers comes from an ancient fear of being rejected by one's clan, which once meant being left on your own to fend for yourself and face roaming predators, a likely death sentence. In any case, it appears that the human amygdala reacts to protect us from being in the vulnerable situation of being observed by potentially hostile animals, including other humans. Fran may not be aware of the evolutionary roots of her reaction and the amygdala's role in it. Her cortex may be telling her that she's afraid of being criticized, humiliated, or making a mistake, while her amygdala is operating from a more prehistoric perspective. The truth is, the cortex often comes up with reasons for our behaviors, which may or may not be accurate explanations. However, the concern here isn't the accuracy of the cortex, but its effects. The more Fran dwells on cortex-generated explanations for her amygdala-based anxiety, such as, "You're worried that your boss will never be satisfied with this presentation," the more cortex-based anxiety she'll create, adding to her problem. Looking in the cortex for the causes of amygdala-based anxiety is like looking in your refrigerator to understand why your car won't start. You aren't looking in the right place. Instead, Fran needs to focus on her amygdala's perspective. She needs to see that her amygdala is trying to protect her. Instead of using her cortex to seek explanations for her anxiety, she needs to use her cortex to apply her knowledge of the language of the amygdala. First, she needs to recognize that her pounding heart and increased rate of breathing, which would help her if she needed to run or fight, don't indicate that she's truly in danger. These responses are part of the amygdala's reaction, and they aren't helpful in the context of public speaking. Fran needs to understand that this isn't a dangerous situation, and that her amygdala is setting off an alarm unnecessarily. Even if the speech Fran is about to give is very important, perhaps for her career, it's unlikely that this is the life or death situation that her amygdala seems to be preparing her for. This underscores the importance of being aware of the amygdala's role as protector. This is crucial in understanding and controlling your own anxiety responses. In many cases, the amygdala's assumption that you need to be protected from danger is incorrect. Fortunately, you can remedy this by retraining your amygdala and by not giving the amygdala more fuel for the fire by assuming that a fearful or anxious emotional reaction is a definite indication of danger. The protective amygdala reaction is often misguided, and you don't want to let your cortex strengthen the reaction. Lastly, it's important to recognize that simply trying to use your cortex to convince yourself that the situation isn't truly dangerous won't always shut off the amygdala's response. A more effective approach is using deep breathing techniques and strategies that retrain the amygdala, and we'll outline this approach in part 2 of the book, Taking Control of Your Amygdala-Based Anxiety. How the Amygdala Decides What's Dangerous. The human amygdala seems predisposed to respond to some stimuli as if they're dangerous. Fears of snakes, insects, animals, heights, angry facial expressions, and contamination seem to be biologically wired into the amygdala because humans learn them with very little prompting. For example, Few children have a car phobia, but many are afraid of insects. Although cars pose a much greater danger to children than insects, the fear of insects seems to be hardwired into the amygdala, such that children develop this fear very easily. This is undoubtedly the result of thousands of years of evolution, in which a fear of insects contributed in some way to survival. However, even fears that are programmed into the amygdala can be changed. If they couldn't, it's unlikely that so many of us would live with sharp-toothed animals, like cats or dogs, and treat them as part of our families. On the other hand, many objects or situations aren't naturally feared by the amygdala. Instead, the amygdala learns to fear them as a result of life experiences. The amygdala is constantly learning based on experience, and after certain negative experiences, it creates brain circuits that cause people to fear a previously unfeared object. For example, a child doesn't naturally fear a flame and must be warned not to touch it. But after a child is burned by, say, a birthday candle, the child's amygdala learns to fear the sight of flames. In addition, the amygdala quickly adds various flaming objects to its list of dangerous things to avoid, so the child may also fear lighters, sparklers, and campfires. The amygdala retains lasting memories that identify the object and similar objects as dangerous. This is a very powerful and adaptive ability because it allows for the creation of specialized neural circuitry that helps people avoid the specific dangers that occur in their lives. This has kept the amygdala useful and virtually unchanged for millions of years. When we explain the two pathways to anxiety to people, they often ask if they could have inherited a sensitive amygdala. Genetics can definitely influence the amygdala and therefore your typical emotional reactions. For example, children who have a smaller left amygdala tend to have more anxiety difficulties than other children. The good news is, every amygdala is capable of learning and changing, and in later chapters you'll learn how to train your amygdala to respond differently. Emotional memories. As discussed in Chapter 1, the amygdala forms memories, but not in the way people typically think about memories. On the basis of your experiences, your amygdala creates emotional memories, both positive and negative, that you don't necessarily have an awareness of. Positive emotional memories, such as the association of the smell of perfume with feelings of love for your partner, usually don't cause much difficulty. Therefore, we'll focus on negative emotional memories, especially those that result in fear and anxiety, because these memories can cause a great deal of amygdala-based anxiety. As noted in Chapter 1, the lateral nucleus of your amygdala creates emotional memories based on your experiences, and these memories can lead you to respond to certain objects or situations as if they're dangerous. Because of these memories, you're conscious of a feeling of discomfort, fear, or dread. However, you don't realize that this feeling is due to an emotional memory because the memory isn't stored as an image or verbal information. It isn't like an old photograph or movie in your mind, as cortex-based memories can be. Instead, you experience an amygdala-based memory directly, as an emotional state. You simply begin feeling a specific emotion. If this feeling is anxiety, it's easy to assume that having a fearful or anxious feeling is an accurate reflection of the dangerousness of a situation if you don't understand the language of the amygdala. Consider Sam, who was in a car accident that severely injured his girlfriend who was driving. To this day, when he rides in the passenger seat of a car, Sam has anxiety, an urgent feeling of danger that seems to result from the current situation in his environment. Sam doesn't experience a memory of the accident or reflect on the accident every time he experiences this amygdala-based anxiety. However, any time he approaches the passenger seat, he has a strong feeling that he must avoid the situation, and he becomes extremely uncomfortable and almost panicky whenever he tries to ride with another driver. If he tries to put his feelings into words, he says it feels like something bad is going to happen if he rides in the passenger seat. He's more comfortable driving himself, and for years he's avoided being a passenger. Because his deeply felt emotional reaction is so real and persistent, he doesn't consider whether he should question it. He would never describe it as a memory formed by his amygdala, and he doesn't expect himself to change it or even realize that he can. Exercise. Getting familiar with the effects of amygdala-based memories. You may wonder what an amygdala-based memory feels like. Listen to the following list of experiences and consider whether any of them are similar to something you felt. Write down any that apply to you. I notice my heart pounding strongly, or my heart rate increasing in certain situations. I avoid certain experiences, situations, or locations without consciously intending to do so. I keep watching or checking on certain things even when I don't really need to. I can't relax or let my guard down in a specific location or type of location. Seemingly insignificant events can make me worry. I can end up in a complete panic very quickly. In certain situations, I feel very angry to the point of wanting to physically fight, but I know that doesn't make sense. I feel a strong urge to escape from certain situations. I feel overwhelmed and can't think clearly in certain settings. Under certain circumstances, I feel paralyzed and can't get myself to do anything. In stressful situations, I can't breathe at a normal rate. I develop a lot of muscle tension in certain situations. All of these statements reflect possible effects of memories formed in the lateral nucleus of the amygdala. If you felt some of these reactions, you were probably experiencing the influence of an amygdala-based memory. Your amygdala may have stored these memories in an attempt to protect you from potential danger. When these memories are activated, it's normal not to understand the reaction you're having or not to feel in control of your responses. Furthermore, you may have come up with erroneous explanations for these reactions, which are based on your cortex's desire to understand what's happening. The fight, flight, or freeze response. As mentioned earlier, the amygdala's central location in the brain places it in an advantageous position to influence other parts of the brain that can change essential bodily functions in a fraction of a second. When danger is detected, the amygdala can affect a number of highly influential structures in the brain, including the brainstem arousal systems, the hypothalamus, the hippocampus, and the nucleus accumbens. These direct connections allow the amygdala to instantly activate motor movement systems, energize the sympathetic nervous system, increase levels of neurotransmitters, and release hormones like adrenaline and cortisol into the bloodstream. This activation creates a cascade of changes in the body. Heart rate increases, pupils dilate, blood flow is shifted away from the digestive tract to the extremities, muscles tense, and the body is energized and primed for action. In response to these physiological changes, you may feel trembling, a pounding heart, and stomach and bowel distress. All of these changes are part of the fight, flight, or freeze response. And as noted previously, the central nucleus is the portion of the amygdala where the fight, flight, or freeze response is initiated. When this reaction is needed, we consider it a life-saving event. But if the central nucleus overreacts, it can set off a full-blown panic attack when no logical reason for fear exists. Once it initiates a panic attack, the central nucleus of the amygdala is in control and the cortex has very little influence. Some people respond very aggressively when they panic. Some flee the situation, and others are immobilized. If you're having a panic attack and people try to provide you with logical reasons why you shouldn't be panicking, they're essentially talking to a cortex that's turned off. Strategies that directly target the amygdala, such as physical activity or deep breathing, will be more effective, and we'll teach you these strategies in chapters 6 and 9. Being aware of the amygdala's ability to take charge is essential information for anyone who struggles with anxiety. It serves as a reminder that everyone's brain is hardwired to allow the amygdala to seize control in times of danger. Countless lives of humans and other animals have been saved by the amygdala's ability to quickly commandeer bodily reactions in dangerous situations. Examples include slamming on the brakes in traffic, ducking when a foul ball is headed your way, or leaving the room when the veins in your boss's neck are bulging. All of these situations are instances when your amygdala is attempting to save you from perceived danger. But as we mentioned, sometimes the well-intentioned amygdala is itself the problem. The language of the amygdala. At this point, you've learned a great deal about how the amygdala creates anxiety. You understand that one of the main functions of the amygdala is to protect you. You also know that it can identify certain objects or situations as dangerous, usually because of a learning experience. You learned that the amygdala creates memories that you may not be aware of, but which you experience as emotions. Finally, you know that the amygdala has an immediate response system that can take over both your brain and your body when it feels that you're in danger. This raises the question of how we can exercise control over the amygdala. To do so, we need to communicate new information to this small but powerful part of the brain. And the best way to achieve this is by using the amygdala's own language. We use the word language here to describe the method of communication between the amygdala and the outside world. This particular language is not one of words or thoughts, but of emotions. When it comes to anxiety, the language of the amygdala has a fairly narrow focus on danger and safety. It's based on experience, and it's a language of quick action and response. When you understand the specifics of this language, your experiences with amygdala-based anxiety will make more sense. And you'll also be able to communicate new information to your amygdala in order to train it to respond differently. As discussed in Chapter 1, a central law underlying the neural circuits in the brain is neurons that fire together, wire together. The amygdala's language is based on creating connections between neurons. When it comes to amygdala-based anxiety, connections between neurons are made when sensory information about an object or situation is being processed by neurons in the lateral nucleus of the amygdala at the same time that something threatening happens to excite the amygdala. In any threatening situation, the amygdala is working to identify any sight, sound, or other sensory information associated with danger. Therefore, association is an essential part of the language of the amygdala. Psychologists have known about association-based learning, typically called classical conditioning, for over a century, but only in the past couple of decades have they recognized that some types of this learning occur in the amygdala. In this book, we make use of many findings from neuroscientist Joseph Ledoux and his team who are researching the neurological basis of amygdala-based anxiety. The amygdala scans the sensory aspects of your life and responds in very specific ways when sensory information is associated with positive or negative events occurring at the same time. When sensations, objects, or situations have been associated with a negative event, memories are stored by the lateral nucleus in circuits that are wired to produce a negative emotion. Emotional learning in the lateral nucleus of the amygdala. Imagine a person being confronted by a dog. The sights and sounds of the dog are processed through the thalamus and relayed directly to the lateral nucleus of the amygdala, which doesn't automatically create a change in neural circuitry that will cause anxiety. Neurons in the lateral nucleus change in such a way that fear is learned only if sensory information about the dog is being processed in the lateral nucleus immediately before or at the same time as the occurrence of a negative experience, such as being threatened or bitten by the dog. Thus, if the dog behaves in a friendly or neutral manner, the lateral nucleus won't create a negative emotional memory about the dog. However, when a painful or negative experience, such as a dog bite, occurs, the neurons transmitting the sensory information about the bite create strong emotional excitation in the lateral nucleus. If this excitation is occurring at about the same time that the lateral nucleus is receiving sensory information about the dog, the lateral nucleus changes neural circuitry to respond negatively to dogs or similar animals in the future. In studies on rats, scientists have actually been able to observe that connections form in the amygdala when such pairings are experienced. An object or situation itself need not be harmful or threatening for fear or anxiety to be associated with it. Any object, even a teddy bear, can come to cause anxiety through association-based learning. For an association to develop, all that's required is that the object be experienced at about the same time that some arousing or threatening event is activating the lateral nucleus. Remember, neurons become connected when they're firing at the same time. The association-based language of the amygdala is what creates many of the emotional reactions you experience. Amygdala-based anxiety is only one example. In the case of anxiety, the lateral nucleus connects sensory information from a situation with the emotion of fear. After this connection has been created, you'll feel anxious whenever the amygdala recognizes similar sensory information. The sights, sounds, or smells associated with the negative event become capable of activating the amygdala's alarm system. The term trigger refers to anything, an event, object, sound, smell, and so on, that activates the amygdala's alarm system as a result of association-based learning. In the example above, dogs become a trigger for anxiety. Triggers are an important aspect of the language of the amygdala. It may seem surprising that any object can become a trigger if it's processed when the amygdala is in an activated state, but amygdala-based anxiety is due to associations, not logic, so triggers need not make logical sense. Here's an example that illustrates how association, not cause and effect, governs amygdala-based anxiety. Josefina was presenting a teddy bear to her grandson, who was running happily toward her. Then he suddenly fell and split his lip open on the driveway. Now he experiences amygdala-based anxiety whenever he sees a teddy bear. Because the perfectly harmless teddy bear was associated with the pain of the injury, the teddy bear became a trigger, leading to a fear of teddy bears. The amygdala's reaction may range from relatively weak to very strong, depending on the experience. For example, you might have a mild dislike of a certain type of food that was associated with a negative experience, such as egg salad that you ate during a stressful family picnic. On the other hand, if you once ate pancakes when you had an illness that later caused you to throw up, you might find that, even years later, just the smell of pancakes makes you nauseous. Before you get the idea that you might be better off without your amygdala, remember that its role is to protect you. In addition, it produces positive emotions due to association-based learning. For example, if your special someone gives you a necklace as a gift, you'll experience feelings of warmth and love for your partner. Later, when you see the necklace, the association formed between the necklace and the emotion of love will make you experience warm, affectionate feelings again. Had the necklace not been paired with a loved one, it would simply be another piece of jewelry. Many positive emotional reactions are produced by the amygdala, so you wouldn't want to get rid of it. In fact, if two people have had different experiences, they can have completely different reactions to the same object, thanks to the language of the amygdala. One of the authors, Catherine, has affectionate feelings for Daddy Longlegs because she frequently encountered them while picking her favorite red raspberries in her grandmother's garden. She has been known to gently pick up Daddy Longlegs and take them out of her home, much to the horror of her co-author, Elizabeth, whose amygdala reacts to Daddy Longlegs as though they're frightful. Exercise. Identifying amygdala emotions in your life. Can you think of harmless situations or objects that elicit amygdala-based anxiety as a result of the association-based language of your amygdala? Have you ever been puzzled by your reaction to something or someone you had no good reason to fear or dislike? Also consider whether you've ever experienced unexpected positive emotions in response to someone or something. These emotional responses could be a reflection of the language of the amygdala. On a separate piece of paper, list examples of both positive and negative reactions. Remember, the items you list for either category need not make logical sense. For example, you may have a negative emotional reaction to the scent of lilacs and a positive emotional reaction to lightning storms. The amygdala's reactions aren't logical. As you can see, amygdala-based emotions aren't rational. They're based on associations, not logic. Consider Beth, who was sexually assaulted while a specific Rolling Stones song was playing. After the assault, whenever Beth heard the song, she felt intense anxiety. Obviously, the Rolling Stones song had nothing to do with the sexual assault, It was just a coincidence that it was playing when the assault occurred. Nonetheless, Beth's amygdala responded to the association between the song and the assault, an extremely negative event. In this way, the amygdala transforms a neutral object or situation into something that creates an emotional reaction. To be more accurate, the object itself isn't transformed, rather it's processed in a new or different way by the amygdala. People experience the connection the amygdala makes between an object and fear, but they may not recognize or understand the connection. They may feel a strong emotional reaction to an object without realizing that a neural connection has been made or understanding why the emotional reaction is occurring. This lack of awareness is completely normal and extends to all sorts of neural functions. For example, you don't have to be consciously aware of the neural circuits that allow you to listen to this book, to sit upright, or to breathe, thank goodness. That kind of awareness would be exhausting. However, for people who suffer with anxiety, having an understanding of the amygdala's significant role in creating fear associations is helpful. It allows you to stop looking for logical explanations and start learning to use the language of the amygdala. We'll use Don, a Vietnam veteran with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, as an example of how having a grasp of the language of the amygdala can be helpful. Don used to experience panic attacks, but then didn't have one for many years. Suddenly, he started having a panic attack each morning for no apparent reason. When encouraged to investigate the situation, Don realized that his panic was closely associated with showering. After a few days of observing his anxiety build as he showered, Don realized that his wife had switched to the same brand of soap that he'd used in Vietnam. The smell of the soap was activating an amygdala response and creating panic attacks. In the language of the amygdala, the soap was a trigger associated with the war. Recognizing that the soap was the reason for his panic attacks was a relief for Don. Knowing the language of the amygdala gave him a new understanding that helped him see that he wasn't going crazy and that his PTSD wasn't starting to take over his life again, something he was very concerned about. In Don's case, understanding the language of the amygdala was helpful, even though it didn't end his anxiety. He still felt anxious whenever he smelled the soap, despite knowing that the soap wasn't dangerous. However, he could put an end to his morning panic attacks by switching to a different brand of soap. For Don, avoiding that brand of soap had no costs. But sometimes the trigger is something more difficult or impossible to avoid. Consider a plumber who has a fear of spiders, which have a way of hiding under sinks, or an office manager who works on the 20th floor and has panic attacks in elevators. In these cases, reducing or eliminating the fear or panic attacks requires retraining the amygdala. We'll explain how to do this in part 2 of the book. For now, simply know that there are ways to change your emotional circuitry. This can be an enormous source of hope. It may be that you aren't sure where a certain emotional reaction came from. Fortunately, it isn't necessary to know the original cause of amygdala-based anxiety in order to change the emotional circuitry. As you'll see in Chapter 7, once you recognize that a specific trigger is associated with an anxiety response, you can take steps to change the circuitry associated with that trigger, even if you don't know the original cause of the emotional memory. Learning from experience. Many people believe that the symptoms of anxiety disorders such as panic, worry, and the avoidance of certain objects or situations should be alleviated by rational argument. Well-meaning family members and friends, and sometimes even people struggling with anxiety, often think logic and reason should change the way the anxious person reacts. But of course, the amygdala isn't logical. For example, if a young boy fears dogs after being bit by one, you won't get very far by saying, "Don't worry about my dog, buddy. He's never bitten anyone. He's all bark and no bite." Once you have a grasp of the language of the amygdala, it's clear why logic-based interventions miss the mark. As you'll see later in the book, many cortex-based anxiety symptoms do respond to logical arguments. But when it comes to amygdala-based anxiety, there's only one sure way for the amygdala to learn. Experience. The amygdala's reliance on experience for learning explains why hours of talk therapy or working through numerous self-help books may not help with anxiety. They may not be targeting the amygdala. If you want the amygdala to change its response to an object, for example, a mouse, or a situation, such as a noisy crowd, the amygdala needs experience with the object or situation for new learning to occur. Experience is most effective when the person interacts directly with the object or situation, although observing another person has also been shown to affect the amygdala. You can reason with the amygdala for hours, but if you're trying to change amygdala-based anxiety, that tactic won't be as effective as a few minutes of direct experience will be. So to change your amygdala's fear response to, say, a mouse, you must be in the presence of a mouse in order to activate the memory circuits related to mice. Only then can new connections be made. Because the amygdala learns on the basis of associations or pairings, it must experience a change in these pairings for the circuitry to change. Not surprisingly, when your mouse memory circuits are activated, you're going to feel some anxiety. Unfortunately, people typically try to avoid such experiences, and this avoidance prevents the amygdala from forming new connections. Returning to the example of the mouse, you may even try to avoid thinking about mice because just the thought of a mouse can cause the amygdala to react, initiating an anxiety response. The amygdala tends to preserve learned emotional reactions by avoiding any exposure to the trigger, which decreases the likelihood of changing that emotional circuitry. Being the ultimate survivalist, the amygdala is purposely cautious, and its default setting is to organize responses that decrease your exposure to triggers. But again, amygdala-based anxiety responses won't change if the amygdala is successful in avoiding triggers. When you come to terms with the idea that you need to activate the amygdala's circuits to generate new associations, you've learned an important lesson. We like the pithy phrase, "activate to generate," as shorthand for this requirement, which is perhaps the most challenging lesson in the language of the amygdala. It's challenging because it involves accepting the experience of anxiety as necessary for new learning to occur. By engaging in experiences that activate the amygdala's memory of a specific object or situation, you communicate to the amygdala in its own language and put it in the best situation for new circuits to form and new learning to occur. Summary. In this chapter, you've learned how the amygdala creates anxiety as a result of the associations it experiences. You've learned that one of the main functions of the amygdala is to protect you, and that the amygdala creates memories that you may not be aware of but experience instead as emotional reactions. The amygdala has an immediate response system that can take over both your brain and your body when it feels you're in danger. But the amygdala can learn from its experiences, and you can use the amygdala's own language of associations to make new connections. In chapters 7 and 8, you'll learn how to rewire the amygdala so that it responds in a calm way. If you've suffered with the mysteries of amygdala-based anxiety for years, this will provide an amazing feeling of empowerment. Chapter 3. How the cortex creates anxiety. Although the amygdala pathway is very powerful in its ability to activate a variety of physical reactions instantly, anxiety can also have its origins in the cortex pathway. The cortex operates in a completely different way than the amygdala, but its responses and circuitry can prompt the amygdala to produce anxiety. Through this process, the cortex can create unnecessary anxiety and also worsen anxiety that originates in the amygdala. Once you understand how your cortex initiates or contributes to anxiety, you can see the possibilities for either interrupting or modifying cortex reactions to reduce your anxiety. Origins of anxiety in the cortex. The cortex can initiate anxiety in two general ways. The first involves how the cortex processes sensory information, such as sights and sounds. As discussed, the thalamus directs sensory information to the cortex as well as to the amygdala. As the cortex processes this information, It can interpret perfectly safe sensations as threatening. It then sends a message along to the amygdala that can produce anxiety. In this case, the cortex turns a rather neutral experience that wouldn't naturally activate the amygdala into a threat, causing the amygdala to react by creating an anxiety response. Here's an example. A high school senior who had applied to several colleges looked at the mail and saw an envelope from one of the colleges he'd applied to. Imagining that it contained a rejection letter, he had a few very anxious moments before opening the envelope. As it turned out, he'd been admitted and had even been awarded a scholarship. Nevertheless, his cortex initiated an anxiety response by interpreting the sight of the envelope in a way that created distressing thoughts, and these thoughts activated his amygdala. This type of cortex-based anxiety depends on the cortex's interpretation of the sensory information it receives. The second general way the cortex can initiate an anxiety response occurs without the involvement of any specific external sensations. For example, when worries or distressing thoughts are produced in the cortex, this can activate the amygdala to produce an anxiety response, even though the person hasn't seen, heard, or felt anything that's dangerous in any way. An example would be parents of an infant who leave their little boy with a babysitter to go out for dinner and suddenly begin to have concerns about their child's safety. Even though the boy is perfectly safe, the parents imagine that he's in distress or being neglected by the sitter. Thoughts and images like these can activate the amygdala even though there's no sensory information indicating that the child is in danger. Cognitive fusion. Before we examine these two general ways in which the cortex creates anxiety, we want to address a process that can occur in both. Cognitive fusion, or believing in the absolute truth of mere thoughts. It's one of the biggest problems created in the cortex, which can produce a rigid belief that thoughts and emotions should be treated as though they reflect an ultimate reality that can't be questioned. Both the high school senior and the worried parents in the examples above may have fallen victim to cognitive fusion by taking their negative thoughts and images too seriously. Confusing a thought with reality is a very seductive process due to the cortex's tendency to believe it possesses the real meaning of every thought, emotion, or physical sensation. Actually, the cortex is surprisingly prone to misinterpretations and errors. It's common to have erroneous, unrealistic, or illogical thoughts, or to experience emotions that don't make much sense. In reality, you need not take every thought or emotion you have seriously. You can allow many thoughts and emotions to simply pass without undue attention or analysis. In Chapter 11, we'll discuss cognitive fusion in detail, help you assess whether you're prone to cognitive fusion, and provide strategies to help you diffuse from thoughts. Anxiety that arises independently from sensory information. Now we'll take a closer look at the different ways the cortex can initiate anxiety. First, we'll consider the type of anxiety that begins as thoughts or images produced by the cortex without any information from your senses. There are actually two subcategories of this process, thought-based and imagery-based, and each typically arises in a different hemisphere of the cortex, with thought-based anxiety coming from the left hemisphere and imagery-based anxiety coming from the right. That said, these two types of cortex-induced anxiety aren't mutually exclusive. In fact, they often occur together. Left hemisphere-based anxiety. Distressing thoughts are more likely to come from the left side of the cortex, which is the dominant hemisphere for language in most people. Logical reasoning, which is produced in the left hemisphere, underlies both worry and verbal rumination. Worry is the process of envisioning negative outcomes for a situation. Rumination is a style of thinking that involves repetitively mulling over problems, relationships, or possible conflicts. In rumination, there's an intense focus on the details and possible causes or effects of situations. Although people may believe thinking processes like worry or rumination will lead to a solution, what actually happens is a strengthening of the circuitry in the cortex that produces anxiety. In addition, rumination has been shown to lead to depression. Whatever you devote a great deal of time to thinking about or think about in great detail is more likely to be strengthened in your cortex. The circuits in the brain operate on the principle of survival of the busiest, and whatever circuitry you use repetitively is likely to be very easily activated in the future. This means that instead of leading to solutions, the processes of worry and rumination create deep grooves in your thinking processes that make you tend to focus on these concerns in your left hemisphere. Sometimes people get lost in repeatedly analyzing situations, creating an experience called anxious apprehension. As these persistent, worrisome thoughts are rehearsed repeatedly in the mind, they become increasingly difficult to dismiss. This type of thinking is especially common among people with generalized anxiety disorder and obsessive-compulsive disorder. Right hemisphere-based anxiety. The human ability to imagine situations in detail comes from the right hemisphere of the cortex, which approaches the world differently than the analytical, verbal, left hemisphere. The right hemisphere is nonverbal and processes things in more holistic, integrated ways. It helps us see patterns, recognize faces, and identify and express emotions. It also provides us with visual images, imagination, daydreams, and intuition. Because of these capacities, it can contribute to anxiety based on imagination and visualization. When you visually imagine something frightening, you use your right hemisphere to do so. When you hear the critical tone of accusations in your imagination, your right hemisphere is involved. If you're particularly good at using your imagination, you can expect your amygdala to respond. The amygdala can become highly activated when the right hemisphere creates frightening images. Research suggests that the right hemisphere is strongly connected to anxiety symptoms. In fact, it's more strongly associated than the left hemisphere with the kind of anxiety in which a person feels strong arousal and intense fear. For example, people with panic disorder are more likely to have right hemisphere-based anxiety. So when you're feeling strong, arousing anxiety, as opposed to apprehensive or worry-based anxiety, the right side of your cortex is more likely to be activated. Vigilance, a general state of alertness in which the whole environment is scanned for indications of danger, is also based in the right hemisphere. Anxiety that arises from the cortex's interpretations of sensory information. Now we'll turn to the other type of cortex-based anxiety described at the beginning of the chapter. Anxiety that arises from the cortex's interpretations of otherwise neutral sensory information. Sometimes you may be in a situation that's perfectly safe, but your cortex responds to sensory information as if it's dangerous or upsetting. Information coming from your senses via the thalamus is given meaning by the way that the circuits in the cortex process and interpret that information. Let's revisit the example of the high school student who thought he was being rejected by a college but was actually being offered a scholarship. His cortex had interpreted an envelope as a source of distressing news and turned it into a very frightening object. The frontal lobes of the human cortex have a well-developed capacity to contemplate future events and imagine their consequences. This is often quite helpful, with the cortex producing interpretations that allow us to respond well to a variety of situations. However, problems begin when the cortex repeatedly reacts in ways that produce anxiety. Whether due to certain learning experiences, specific physiological processes, or, most frequently, a combination of both, the circuitry in the cortex can respond in ways that promote worry, pessimism, and other negative interpretive processes. We'll discuss this in greater detail in Part 3 of the book. If your cortex interprets a perfectly safe situation as threatening, you'll feel anxiety. Consider Damon, who's walking his dog in his neighborhood. He sees a fire truck heading in the direction of his house with its lights on and sirens blaring, and interprets this to mean that his house is on fire. As a result, he starts to feel tremendous anxiety. The cause of his anxiety is his cortex's interpretation of the meaning of the fire truck, not the fire truck itself. The thoughts produced in Damon's cortex, not the actual event of seeing the fire truck, are what created his anxiety. In fact, from Damon's location, it's impossible to have information that confirms that his house or anyone's house is on fire, so there's no reason that seeing this fire truck should produce anxiety. It may be reasonable for his cortex to come to the conclusion that there could be a fire, but other explanations exist, such as an accident or medical emergency that has nothing to do with a fire or Damon's house. But instead of considering these options, Damon imagines that his house is on fire. As a result, his left hemisphere gets to work considering the ways a fire could have started, thinking, I may have left the stove on, or the wiring is so old. Maybe a short started a fire. Meanwhile, his right hemisphere is creating images of his kitchen engulfed in flames. His amygdala is likely to react to these kinds of thoughts and images, and in response, Damon may rush home in a panic, even though there's no actual threat to his home. His interpretation is the source of his anxiety. Anticipation, the gift of the human cortex. Because the human cortex has the ability to predict future events and imagine their consequences, we experience anticipation, which is both a blessing and a curse. Anticipation, which refers to expectations about what will occur, is based on the cortex's ability to begin preparing for a future event by considering or visualizing it. It occurs primarily in the prefrontal cortex, which lies behind the forehead, on the left, more verbal side. The left prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain where we plan and execute actions, so it's not surprising that anticipation arises here, as it's about getting ready to act in some way. We can anticipate in positive ways and feel excited and eager about an upcoming event. However, we can also anticipate in negative ways, expecting and imagining negative or even dangerous events. This can lead to a great deal of distress. The anticipation of negative situations creates threatening thoughts and images that can significantly increase anxiety. In fact, the experience of anticipation is often more distressing than the anticipated event itself. In many cases, the thoughts and images people have about an upcoming situation, such as a potential confrontation, an exam, or a task that must be completed, are much worse than the actual situation turns out to be. As you can see, the cortex's ability to use language, produce images, and imagine the future allows it to initiate an anxiety response in the amygdala even when no reason for anxiety exists. People usually find it easier to recognize the cortex's role in creating anxiety than the amygdala's role. This is because we're more able to observe and understand the language of thoughts and images produced in the cortex. Some parts of the cortex are more directly under our control than the amygdala is, and we're more able to interrupt and change cortex-created thoughts and images. That said, we don't mean to suggest that controlling the cortex is easy. Your cortex has established certain patterns of responding, and once it has developed these habits, it can be challenging to interrupt and change them. But they can be changed, and we'll explain how you can accomplish this in Part 3 of the book. The final step in the cortex pathway to anxiety, the amygdala. Discussion of the cortex pathway isn't complete until we address the role of the final component in the pathway, the amygdala. On its own, the cortex can't produce an anxiety response. The amygdala and other parts of the brain are needed to accomplish that. In fact, people without a functioning amygdala, whether due to stroke, illness, or injury, don't experience fear in the way most people do. Consider the case of a woman whose amygdalas were both destroyed by a rare condition, Urbach-Wiethe disease. Her story offers a glimpse of what life is like without the amygdala's fear response. She can be exposed to spiders or snakes or watch terrifying scenes from horror movies without experiencing fear. Even more remarkably, in the course of her daily life, she was held up at gunpoint and also was almost killed during an assault, but experienced no fear in either situation. In fact, she's been the victim of a variety of crimes, probably because she lacks the caution that would arise from a functioning amygdala. Her experience illustrates that the amygdala is the source of the fear response. No matter what thoughts, images, or expectations originate in the cortex, many of the emotional and physiological aspects of anxiety result only when the cortex activates the amygdala. The amygdala responds to information passed on from the cortex. In fact, the amygdala may respond to what we imagine in much the same way that it responds to what's actually happening. Information based on thoughts or images of potential danger travels the same pathways as information associated with actual perceptions and interpretations. As discussed earlier, the amygdala almost instantly processes information it receives directly from the senses via the thalamus. After a delay during which the cortex processes and interprets the information, the amygdala also receives information from the cortex. Neuroscientists don't yet know exactly how the amygdala distinguishes whether the information it receives from the cortex is valid or based on an overactive imagination. Let's look at two examples of how the amygdala might respond to thoughts or images created in the cortex to examine how the amygdala's reliance on the cortex can be either beneficial or problematic. In the first example, Charlotte is at home one evening when she hears the familiar sound of someone coming in the back door. She hears this noise every night when her husband comes home, so her amygdala doesn't respond to the sound as a signal of danger. But Charlotte knows in her cortex that her husband is away on a fishing trip and that no one should be coming in the back door at this time. Her cortex produces thoughts of danger and an image of a stranger entering her home. These thoughts and images in Charlotte's cortex influence her amygdala to initiate the fight, flight, or freeze response. Charlotte's heart starts pounding and she stops what she's doing. She becomes hypervigilant and focuses on getting herself to safety. If there is an intruder, these reactions could save her life. Charlotte's amygdala isn't responding to the sound of the door. It's responding to Charlotte's thoughts that there may be a stranger in the house. Responding to information from the cortex allows the amygdala to guard against dangers it doesn't recognize. The amygdala relies on the cortex to provide it with additional information. But sometimes the amygdala's reliance on the cortex leads to unnecessary anxiety, as in the next example. In this scenario, Charlotte is once again alone at home while her husband is away. She doesn't hear anything unusual, but she feels uneasy when she goes to bed. As she lies in bed listening to the quiet night, she imagines that someone is breaking into the house. She imagines an intruder walking around inside the house carrying a weapon. And her amygdala responds to these images in her cortex. Even though there's no direct evidence that she's in any danger, her amygdala still responds to the activity in her cortex by initiating the fight, flight, or freeze response. Suddenly, Charlotte feels a terrible sense of dread. Her breathing becomes shallow, and she feels she should hide or seek help, even though she realizes that there's no strong evidence of danger. Charlotte's amygdala is responding to the thoughts and images in her cortex as if they reflect actual danger, and it creates a very real fear response. As you can see from these two examples, what you think about and focus on in the cortex can definitely affect your level of anxiety. From the perspective of the amygdala, thoughts or images in the cortex may call for a response, even if the amygdala itself doesn't detect danger from the sensory information it received more directly. In reacting to the cortex's information, the amygdala may initiate the fight, flight, or freeze response. And once the amygdala gets involved, you begin to experience the physical sensations associated with anxiety. Fortunately, a number of techniques can be used to interrupt and change cortex-based thoughts and images that may activate the amygdala. With practice, you can rewire your cortex to be less likely to activate your amygdala. The first step is to recognize when the cortex is producing thoughts or images that may lead to anxiety. When you become aware of these thoughts and their anxiety-inducing effects, you can begin to recognize the thoughts, identify when they occur, and take steps to change them. Summary. At this point, you're familiar with a variety of ways that anxiety can be initiated in the cortex. You've seen that the amygdala can be activated by thoughts from the left hemisphere or images from the right hemisphere. You've also been informed of the dangers of cognitive fusion and learned ways that the cortex's interpretations and anticipations